Welcome to Help and Hope, a podcast of CCEF.
Thanks for joining us this week on Help and Hope. My name is Andrew Ray, and this week we'll be discussing an Ask the Counselor question we received, and it has to do with healing after adultery. And here with me today I have
Winston Smith
and
Julie Lowe.
Thanks for coming in. I wanted to start off with seven fun questions. You guys ready for those?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Drum roll in the background. Okay, here we go. What is your favorite Dr. Seuss book?
I'm going to go with Green Eggs and Ham.
Why?
Because life is full of stuff that you don't think is going to taste good, but you have to give it a whirl, and it turns out that that'd be so bad.
Wow, that you summed up the book pretty
That's
quickly
very
there.
Well,
I had my devotional this morning out of that, just so happens.
Green Eggs and Ham.
Oh, boy. I didn't realize they came out with a devotional book with Dr. Seuss as that.
That could be your next book, Winston.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Seuss actually has a book that he wrote before he died, and it never got published. It's called My Many Color Days, and it's all about how you feel on different days. So I use that a lot in counseling with kids, so it's probably one of my favorites right now.
Huh. Now, if it wasn't published, how do you know about it?
Because they published it after his death, and it's one of the few books that he didn't have the privilege of illustrating.
Oh, okay.
So it's very different illustration than his typical Dr. Seuss books.
Huh. Now, do you know what illustrator they chose? That would be a high calling. That's like editing a C.S. Lewis book that he never finished or something like that.
Yeah. No, I don't remember who the illustrator is.
Yeah.
I didn't pay attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still going to go with Green Eggs and Ham. Sorry.
If you could live in any home on a television series, what would it be?
Oh. No way. The Cleaver family? Maybe Eddie Haskell's family.
Maybe Adam's family?
Oh, how about the Waltons? That's nice.
Oh, the Waltons.
Yeah, maybe the Waltons.
Yeah. How about you?
I might agree with that. Yeah. Or Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah, you got some country, big yard.
Hmm. Or Richie Rich would be pretty nice.
Richie Rich.
We're really dating ourselves, though. I mean,
I would have chosen the Brady Bunch.
Really?
But seeing as I'm not being in it. Well, they had that 70s style Los Angeles home with the stairs and the big main room there. I always liked that. You know, and then the dad had his study to do his architect work, which you never saw him really doing work. But supposedly he had a home office there.
Hmm.
Like Mr. Huxtable in The Cosby Show. You know, he had his
OBGYN.
That'd be a good one.
That was like a townhouse in the city.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest you've gone without sleep?
I don't know that I've ever gone even 24 hours.
What?
No, I'm not good at that.
Not in college or anything?
No, because I think even when I could give myself reasons to go without sleep, I just function so poorly after, you know, I get up to like hour 18 or 19 that I just say, well, it's just better to get some sleep and start fresh in the morning. So I don't have any exciting stories there.
You must have wrote your papers on time.
Tried to.
Or suffered the consequences. Yeah. I couldn't do it either. There were a couple times I tried to pull all-nighters, and at some point you don't think clearly anymore. I don't think clearly anymore. And I don't care if the house burns down, if wild elephants come through, if it's my last life moment. I just think, oh, I need to sleep.
Yeah.
Then I wake up the next day in a panic. But
yeah, I really think it's usually not a very good use of time. You're so inefficient when you're sleep deprived. It's just...
Yeah. Well, I wish I had that advice 10 years ago. What's your favorite Barry Manilow song?
Barry Manilow.
I don't even know what I can think of. I write the songs. That's the only one that comes to my mind. What else did he write?
I have no idea. Who's your favorite Muppet?
Muppets. I like the Judges. The Judges are very cool.
Up in the booth there?
Up in the booth.
That's what I was going to say. I didn't know there were Judges.
Yeah. Oh, actually, I really like the Swedish Chef.
Mm.
And his cohort, Beaker.
Yes. Beaker. I used to love The Muppet Show.
Hmm.
Yes, that's a dying classic, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say The Judges, too, although I didn't know they were judges. I just thought they were all guys in the balcony. They had great lines.
Does that suggest a cynicism in the two of you?
Probably.
Hey, we'll do the counseling stuff. You just ask the questions.
Stop psychoanalyzing.
Yeah. They just had great lines. That's really, it's not any more deep than that.
No, yeah. What's the best bargain you've ever found at a garage sale or a thrift store?
Well, this isn't my find, but my wife Kim brought home this cracked kind of marble looking lamp one time. It was like a church kind of yard sale, and we took it to a lamp store to get it fixed and to buy a shade for it, and it turned out it was alabaster.
And what is
which means it was like worth, you know, several hundred dollars. Oh. She got it for like $5.
It's neat. I've not been that lucky. Maybe a stained glass.
And where do you put the stain? Do you have it like on a wall or something?
Yeah, it hangs.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Final question. What do you order when you eat Chinese food?
I can tell what you order.
Go ahead. I get this. I mean, there's only one little local place that we ever go, and they have this dish called Chiang chicken, which I call, it's like southern fried barbecue chicken, Asian style. So it's just very tangy fried little pieces of chicken. It's not nothing, you know, exotic.
Probably nothing to do with China.
Probably not. It's probably, yeah.
I like egg rolls. Fried rice and egg rolls are the staple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what my wife likes, the egg roll. She'll buy three of those and nothing else.
And the orange sauce.
This was
yeah.
easy. I thought we were going to get like a really hard questions
deep,
today. That
deep
was
conversation.
Easy.
Conversation.
No, that's it. Done? Well, thanks for coming. Just kidding. today we want to talk a little bit about healing for broken marriages, and we get a lot of questions in our Ask the Counselor series about broken marriages, as you can imagine. I think David Pallison once said, 80% of counseling is either those who are married and don't want to be married, or those who are not married and want to be married. Mm. And then, you know, of course, there's
a lot. You
should
put them all in a group together and do some group work with them.
Yeah, I'll talk to him about that. So, anyways, it's funny because I had a couple of questions prepared for this morning, and then we received another one literally this morning at early in the morning, and I wanted to read the question. It goes like this. Here's a question from one of our listeners. I am counseling a couple in an adultery situation where the wife is unable to overcome the feelings of pain, anger, and betrayal. She views her repentant husband as dirty and disgusting because of what he did. Though we have spent weeks talking about how our forgiveness being based on God's forgiveness of us, she continues to live by her feelings, not by God's word. How can I help her overcome her feelings?
Well, I think there's probably more than this going on, but I think I hear in the question a typical problem in our approach to helping people recover from adultery, and that is I think we often rush to or rush through the process of forgiveness. And there's several reasons that can happen. One can be the person who's committed adultery is genuinely sorrowful, incredibly ashamed, and wants this episode over as quickly as possible and part of the past. And so they ask for forgiveness. And one, part of our understanding of forgiveness is this means we've dealt with it and we don't have to talk about it anymore. When the person who was sinned against, the innocent party, we'll call them, they've just absorbed or are trying to absorb this monumental blow to their marriage and to themselves. And often by the time, you know, sometimes when the adulterous party is asking for forgiveness, the other spouse is just beginning to experience what that feels like and what that means. They're just maybe even just coming out of shock at the point in which the other person is asking for forgiveness, and they haven't had a chance to really understand how they've been injured so that they can really process what's happened and offer a fully developed form of forgiveness because they've had the time to express and understand what's happened to them. So, and again, there may be much more going on in this situation than that, But I wonder if this woman has had an adequate chance to really talk about and reveal her heart and share how she's been wounded, and get beneath just the angry feelings of outrage and disgust to the hurt and the fear and the shame that she's experiencing. So maybe she's, you know, maybe there's been a kind of a hasty request for forgiveness that in effect takes issue off the table. And maybe the other piece of it is she's at that stage where all she's really willing to process at this point is anger and disgust, and she hasn't had a chance or been helped to get to some of the other very normal experiences of being betrayed.
So in effect, it's as if we can overlook the depth mm-hmm. of the wound in a spouse who has been betrayed in this way, and I wonder, you use the word, we can rush through forgiveness, and I wonder in that rush process, in rushing, if, you know, it seems like often we want forgiveness because we want to feel better, we just want things to be right as quickly as possible, mm-hmm. but in that process we're not considering the person and the depth of
right.
their wound.
We're, in a sense, without thinking of it this way, we're using the language of forgiveness to avoid hard things and extremely painful emotions. Mm. And that's not God's ultimate purposes for forgiveness. If we're not willing to look squarely at and with real depth at the wound and the sin and what's happened, then you're going to misapply forgiveness and it's not going to do its work. You're going to use the language of forgiveness to really skirt the issue, take it off the table in the relationship, and both parties are really left kind of with a buried wound that's just going to fester and explode again at some point.
Hmm. I guess the secondary issue would be if there has been an adequate amount of time, and time is such an intangible thing in those circumstances, but mm-hmm. what do you do with a spouse that is stuck, that is not working through it, that is not processing it well, that is holding on to anger and resentment and indignation that he or she has been wronged, which sounds like that's partly what he's asking there as well in the question. So it could be they didn't give adequate amount of time. It could be, what do you do? Should you get to a place where you've given time and energy and effort and you actually see somebody maybe wallowing in that state? And that's part of the struggle at times as well for spouses, where they're just not able to get over something that seems too significant in their mind, or they're incapable of fathoming that their spouse could do something like that. And that could be born out of maybe a self-righteousness that I would never do that. I'm not capable of that kind of sin. Or a real sense of just complete brokenness and struggling to work through that. I just think that's the whole spectrum mm-hmm. of saying it could be my sinful anger and tendency. It could also be I'm so incredibly shocked and broken over it that I need more time and space.
Mm. Or just to complicate it even further, kind of an unspoken sense of, well, if I forgive, I'm just setting myself up to let it happen to
yeah,
me again.
It's like it was okay to do it.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and it could be just a messy combination of all the above.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And moving forward with someone broken like this, and you have that combination of potential influences and things going on in their hearts, where would you start with, let's say this person says it's a self-righteousness issue. Where do you say, how do you gently, to someone who's been really hurt, say, you have the potential to do this as well? I mean, how do you say that to someone as a counselor?
Well, I think you don't start there for
yeah.
sure. That wouldn't be the first thing you say
mm-hmm.
to someone who has been betrayed.
Right.
So I think if you've been a good, compassionate, careful listener to, you know, to the sense of hurt, shame, and betrayal, then you sort of earn the right to say those other things because you've been with them on the front end of that conversation.
And you understand them well.
Yeah. So I think, and I think you don't, you pose that to them as something to consider, to think about. That's not a conclusion that you hand to them. You just say, this is, here's a place where we can get stuck. Here are some things I'm hearing you say that make me wonder if your heart's taking you in that direction. What do you think? You know, help me understand what's going on right now with you. So there are humble and compassionate ways to even explore issues of self-righteousness, because we're all capable of that, of being prideful, judgmental, self-righteous people. So we need to bring compassion and understanding even to that challenge.
And if it's not a self-righteousness issue, and we, of course, we're just working through all the potentials here, or some of them, what if it is a forgiveness question? And simply, how is forgiveness a process? Can you guys talk a little bit about how, I know Jesus has called us to forgive not seven times, but 77 times, and how is forgiveness a process in terms of we want to forgive someone who has wronged us, and that is just an awesome, and I mean that in a terrible sense, what sense of betrayal? That's a big betrayal. And so to forgive there, boy, that seems like that word is loaded. What does that process look like to a certain extent?
Well, it seemed like you're taking a lot of things into consideration there. So, for example, the shock value of it, the level of betrayal involved, maybe the level of repentance that's really involved or not involved. You know, was it a half-hearted repentance? Was the person caught versus the person confessed? Was it your best friend? You know, so many things that could add to the complication of multiple relationships that could be involved in the forgiveness process. To, is the marriage reconcilable? To, you know, how were children brought into it or not brought into it? That I think just affect the process, not the need to forgive, but certainly the process and the elements of it and the weightiness of it. And so for some, for a spouse, it might also be the fact that children are feeling betrayed and they're dealing with their children's hurt and anger, which is reigniting their own hurt and struggle to forgive. So sometimes you realize that the process can be complicated by a lot of things as well. And you give people time to grieve, you give them time to ask questions, you give them time to process and understand. But you see that they're moving towards that, and you see that there's a brokenness where they can go the other way, where there's a hardening of heart. So I think that's part of the wisdom issue, where you're looking for, are they moving in one direction versus the other direction?
So when we consider reconciling marriages and couples who have gone through betrayal, what are two or three ways that you have found that couples can come together, can find healing, and find that reconciliation in their marriages?
I think a couple of truths that tend to come to the forefront in that process is one, a sense of shared responsibility for the problems in the marriage that perhaps contributed to the adultery. And I want to carefully nuance that. What I'm not saying is that somehow the one spouse is responsible for the other spouse's choice to commit adultery. But adultery, more often than not, doesn't happen in a vacuum. People don't just wake up one day and say, I think I'll commit adultery today. There are usually weaknesses in the relationship that create a vulnerability there that allow for that temptation to take hold. So I think without laying the responsibility of the adultery in the other spouse's lap, I think it's helpful when when both spouses are able to at least accept responsibility for the weaknesses in the marriage that, that created that vulnerability. So a sense that there's something, you know, there's something bigger going on in our marriage already that we need to get to. That I think is often an important step. And part of that is this other truth, this more foundational truth, which is a sense of a horrible thing has happened, but grace, part of what grace means is that God is able to accomplish his good purposes for us. God is able to love us even in the midst of and through horrible things. Mm-hmm. God will use this to restore our marriage, and it's worth being restored. Mm-hmm. So just the sense of this is part of a bigger story. This is something that God is going to be active in, and mm-hmm. he's going to bless us and give us grace in this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would add to that that you often find in marriage this expectation of return, that I am godly and loving, therefore you will be godly and loving. And so that's what makes it so much more a betrayal at times for people. And one of the things I would think hinder that regularly is the sense that you need to make this up to me. And what are you going to do in this constant proving of mm-hmm. oneself? Mm-hmm. And when a spouse is able to let go of that and say, there's no expectation of return. There's no expectation of you making this up to me. I just freely give you grace. Mm-hmm. Real healing can begin. The spouse can really feel that grace and that conviction and that desire to, on their own, be a better spouse. And then I'm also committed to just saying, God's up to doing a work in me. If I'm the spouse that has been sinned against, of just what Winston said as well, of saying, you know, God's up to something in my life as well, and he's doing something deep and meaningful in me as much as he hopefully is in my spouse and my marriage. And when you have those things going on, there's not an expectation of return or a demand for making it up, and I'm able to see how God is up to something in my own life, then the focus is much less on that issue and much more on a God who's sovereign over my marriage.
I think actually what Julie and I are both doing as we even talk about it is we're taking the word forgiveness, which we all sort of think we know what it means, and we're trying to translate that into real, tangible, concrete, practical things, breaking it into smaller pieces, which I think is also a, you know, a really important part of healing and growing through it.
Yeah, so it doesn't take away the pain automatically, but it gives people an ability to see past the event into a greater purpose in it or a greater need.
Well, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Green eggs and ham.
Sam, I am. The end.
Thank you for joining us. For more information about CCEF and its resources, visit us on the web at ccef.org.